Howdy, y'all. Welcome to Components Live. I'm Ren, product marketer at Heretto and your podcast MC.
I'm Patrick, CEO here at Heretto.
And I'm Jared, lead solutions consultant.
Thanks for joining us on our weekly conversation about componentized and structured content. Hope you enjoy this 15 or so minutes of fun talking about everything from data to innovations in AI.
Glad you're catching our live show after it was live and is now a podcast. If you want to join the live show, we stream every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern on LinkedIn and YouTube, but you can always find the recording on your favorite podcast app. All right, let's get into it.
Hello, everyone. Happy Friday. We are back. And again, the whole gang is here and we have another special guest today. I'm really excited. There's four squares on the screen and it makes me super happy. So Casey is joining us. And we are going to talk about something he shared with the Heretto team this morning. NVIDIA just did a big announcement about some of their new advancements, and Casey had a lot of thoughts to share about it. And so we want to give him the stage to kind of talk about what they unveiled and why it's important.
So I think it was about 2 or 3 days ago. So it's kind of late news in the AI world, but I was just kind of catching up on some things, and they've unveiled a new chip architecture called the Blackwell chip architecture. And you can go and watch videos about this or read about it. The net of it is that this is a beast of a system for doing AI processing. And one of their big advancements in this is that they've basically been able to provide these linkages between these chips, where they just act as like one giant chip. So it's like a 10 terabyte per second for people that know those values transfer between the chips. So this is exciting and terrifying. Why is it terrifying? Because the pace of advancement on the software and now also hardware side is just breakneck, and there's no sense of any of this slowing down to have some rational conversations about whether or not this is the right thing to be doing. We're just going for it. So that's exciting because we're going to be, you know, seeing a lot of really novel, interesting things happen. But it's also terrifying because of the obvious unknowns that we've all been talking about. And you might ask yourself, well, what does this have to do with content? And I think it has a lot to do with content. So these new chip architectures, they're packing a lot more into about the same amount of space. And so what that means is that infrastructure providers can kind of just replace what they currently have with like much more powerful engines that lets them generate a lot more content a lot faster. But it also means that I think we're going to be seeing these things scale down even smaller. And we're going to be getting to the point where these are going to be running on devices that are in your home, potentially. Like a lot of open source models, LLMs, can be running these things, and you could actually own the model with your content inside it, whether you're an organization that's providing that as a service or whether you're even a tech-savvy individual. And the cost of these are going to drop. And one of the things that it's made me think about and kind of topic for discussion today is that I think we're going to see a lot of these systems, because they can handle so much more information within the same space and do so much more processing. A lot of these systems are going to be able to take large sets of content and actually use that as how it drives the behavior of whatever the system is. So instead of going and having to be someone who's a technical programmer or knows about machine learning, all you need to do is be able to go and write content for how something should behave, whether it's a software you use or whether it's actually something that's in your home and you want to interact with it. And I think that's really fascinating because it kind of democratizes a lot of this technology more, which is a good thing. And it's a really interesting link.
Yeah, that was my thing too. Like, does it really democratize it? It makes it easier to use.
Well, I guess it depends on who can afford to have the platform. So if we assume that, you know, the whole idea of OpenAI, at least, was that it would not be open source, but, or at least is what they say, it would be open for people to use, because before that, you know, Google and Microsoft and Amazon, they all had these big AI models, but nobody could use them outside of that. So now you're seeing this pop up more and more places where, like, it's open in the sense that, you know, anybody could use it. Might be a budgetary concern, but it's at least there to be used. And I think if we assume the cost and a drop on this and availability increases, that you'll see it be more democratized. And I do think that's a good thing, because I think it would be way worse if it was just a few companies that had this stuff closed off within their walls, utilizing it and offering it as kind of a black box service.
That's fair. This makes me think of something that was in the coffee and content we did yesterday, where we were speaking with this guy, Mike Dillinger, who does, you know, a lot of research on taxonomy and ontology and all that stuff. And at one point in the conversation, we're talking about AI. And I was like, how do you get the taxonomy into the AI? And because I've actually tried a bunch of stuff with this. Like, I've tried like passing it SCOS files or RDF files or things like that. And it's sort of worked, like putting it inside of the prompt. And he was like, well, the thing that we found is most successful is actually just taking the RDF or the SCOS or whatever it is and turning it into plain language. So like, Casey is a nerd. And like, you have that association now. Like, Jared is also a nerd, this kind of thing. So like, you just basically, you basically write these out into like phrases or sentences. And like, that's the best way to approach training, or not. Well, I guess it's not really training in that case, unless you're actually training, because it might, could be part of the prompt, but putting it into the AI model for leveraging it and whatever you're doing. So it sounds like what you're saying is like, these things get bigger and faster and more capable. Your context base gets bigger. You can do more of that. The price comes down. It's more democratized. So all of that is good. But then the terrifying side is that all of a sudden it's democratized and anybody can do this stuff with it.
Yeah, there's no slowing down, because it's kind of like an arms race, you know. But that's exactly it. And I think that, you know, it doesn't even need to be somebody necessarily writing this guidance. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could talk to an AI over time and it could record that information, and then it would be available for you to go and edit, but you wouldn't necessarily have to go in and actually write like a whole manual on its guidance. You could have it accumulate it over time. The same thing with those relationships, and it could accumulate it from all kinds of different ways. It could accumulate it from observation. If you had an in-home care robot or something, could just accumulate it through observation of who's helping who, what are their roles and things like that, which also could be really interesting for organizations who want to understand how their processes work better, because now you're recording all this information, which again, could be a bad thing or could be a good thing. You're recording all of this information that's just being fed into these systems that can be analyzed in terms of like, how is the organization actually working or running? Like, I think a lot of organizations, they know what roles they have in the organization, but oftentimes those roles are doing multiple things. They might be doing work outside of their current role. You might have someone who's got a ton of deep knowledge somewhere that you don't even know that they have that knowledge until you observe how they're working within the organization. And it's also terrifying, but really interesting.
The passive aspect, like, of it. I think this actually bridges over in an interesting way to like what I wanted to be my hot topic today, because we're talking about, you know, effectively working with these systems is controlling the information space they exist in, right? Like, so exactly. The difference between an AI system that is doing what you want it to do and is under your control and having the right output, and one that is less predictable is really controlling the information space. So all of a sudden, I feel like there's been this rebirth in the conversations around information architecture. Like, it's like the last couple of months, all of a sudden there's just been a lot more talking about this, and from a bunch of different angles. I posted something on LinkedIn and it got a lot of interest. So I think that's very interesting when it comes to like the pace of advancement and like what we need to be doing to leverage it, I guess.
Yeah. Go on.
Say more words. Yeah.
What were some of like the, based on the things that people were saying in to your post, like with the replies, like what do you, is there a big change that you're feeling from prior? Like, you're saying there's a shift, right? So like, what are you feeling is the shift? Can you synthesize it, or are you still kind of processing that?
No, I think I can. And I think that it's actually not that complicated. I think the big thing that has changed, or maybe if it hasn't entirely changed, people see that it's coming, you know, like, you know, what Casey is observing here with these technologies, is that what you can get away with is a lot less than it was 5 years ago. And as you're looking to interact with like these insanely scalable systems and experiences and things like that, the amount of governance you need, the amount of predictability you need, the amount of control and consistency you need, it's just gone up a couple levels. So like in the past, like you could get away with things that were a little bit loosier, goosier across the chain, because like you had people as being, you know, the final usage of a system in almost all cases. And, you know, people are pretty flexible. Like people can tell when something's not exactly right, and they can navigate information systems kind of intuitively. That's like one of the things we do really, really well. And I think we're now seeing with where we're going, that's not going to be an option in the future. And if you want to be ready to like really take advantage of technologies that are built on, you know, the outputs of information spaces, you have to have information architecture. So some people are ahead of this and they know how to iterate on it. Some people are like, whoa, where do we start? And some people still think they don't need it, which is an interesting conversation when you run into that one. But it's kind of all over the board. And I think it's just kind of, I never thought I would find myself in a place where I'd be like, oh yeah, information architecture is going to be one of the most interesting topics in the space in 5 years or something like that. Like I just didn't see that coming. So it's been kind of interesting.
I thought the post was good because it was challenging the basic assumption that like you only need information architecture if you have highly, highly structured content, which is just not the case. Mm-hmm. You're going to need it. And unfortunately you have it in some form or fashion. Even if you're doing all this in Word documents, like there's an architecture there. It's very loose in that sense. And it's not highly controlled and it's not highly scalable, but there is one there that you're employing, whether you want to admit that or not. And so I think this is one of those things where there's a cultural shift that has to take place with this. Like we're moving into an age where information is going to be consumable by machines even more and more so. And so you got to have something there. You've got to have an architecture, and it's worth thinking about what that is. I also think that you shouldn't let it intimidate you either. You don't, just because there are like DITA, for example, DITA can be complex. It can be as complex as you want it to be. And it's very powerful because of that. It doesn't have to be that way. Take what you need, leave what you don't in an information architecture. But one thing is just don't let it intimidate you. Just think about it, plan it, and add in the complexity as you need it.
I think the iterative aspect of it is probably some of the best advice. Now, some people need to start with a lot more than others. Like there's no doubt about that. But you know, really realistically, like if there's one reason you choose DITA as the foundational structure for your content over any other option, it's DITA's ability to be iterative over time as your needs change, and like incorporating that back into your information architecture and your information model. Like that's really the final selling point of DITA. And if you build something else that does that, you've just rebuilt DITA. Like that's what it is. So there's no reason to not use it. And that's actually kind of stealing a quote from Elliot Kimber, because I was challenging him on this like probably like 6 months ago. And we got to this place in the conversation where he goes, why wouldn't you just use DITA if you've rebuilt the whole thing? And I was like, well, that's actually a really good point.
Well, because you've rebuilt the whole thing, you can't just throw that out, man. I'm going to reuse what I built.
All right. Exactly. Cost. Jared, you interact with a lot of people who are like starting their journey on this stuff. Like, what are you seeing in this right now?
People are starting to notice it. One thing that I think has been, I see a broad range. Like I was just chatting with somebody. They've been in DITA for a long time. This is very commonplace for them. They ask questions during this call, and it was about the system. It was about Heretto, but it was about how Heretto handles specific information architectures. Like the whole conversation was effectively about information architecture wrapped in this language of how does Heretto deal with state the use case that has a specific information architecture. So I have calls like that. And then I have people who are like, hey, we're still producing everything in Word and Google Docs, and it's just not sustainable anymore. what should I consider moving forward? And the first thing I say is, think about your information architecture. Think about the structure that you need for a particular output that you're aiming for. What is your end goal? And then let's work our way backwards. And let's add in the complexity that's required to achieve that end goal. And then we'll go from there. And the people are really open to that. And I also encourage people to bite off manageable chunks of that planning. Then go for walks, like take breaks.
I go for a walk every day. So
I don't.
For what that's worth.
I don't.
Well, I've got a little dog and he wants to go for a walk. So I think that the one thing I would add to that is I think there needs to be a sense of urgency around this as much as there doesn't need to be a sense of like fear. Because I think we're getting into a place now where if you're still in Word, you're still in unstructured, like if your approach to content operations isn't going to be scalable and structured and have all of the different like linkage and metadata and all those types of things you need to be able to reliably produce the information space that's going to facilitate machines that you're trying to work with and experiences, the longer you wait to resolve that, the more rushed it's going to have to be. Because like, if you really get to a place where like you are staring at like a really detrimental difference between yourself and your competitor in terms of an experience or an ability to deliver a capability or whatever it may be, and you realize you have to go and build all of the infrastructure to do that at that point in time, that's just not a good place to be. So I don't think we're in a place yet where people should be panicking about this, depending, I think, maybe on your industry. But I think broadly speaking, they don't need to be. But I do think that this really needs to be top of mind. And we're seeing that it is for a lot of people. Like this has definitely been one of the most interesting periods from like people coming and like recognizing like the importance of this that we've seen. I mean, frankly, like Casey and I, at the very least, have been around this for a little while.
It's super interesting because I think, you know, when you look at the intersection of information architecture and some of the advancements in AI, like, you know, we're kind of seeing that everyone's going to have, you know, besides the really big businesses, everyone's going to have kind of the same access to AI. Mm-hmm. So what's going to make the difference is their information architecture. And everyone has an information architecture, whether or not you've thought about it or not. It's in there somewhere. And the question is it serving you well? Mm-hmm. And when everyone has the access to roughly the same level of computational power, how much further ahead is your competitor going to be if they've got their information architecture serving them well and aligned with those use cases? And I think it's going to be enormous at the pace of development. So
don't be afraid, but everybody panic.
Casey said, go get all of your provisions right now. Hunker down. It's the end of the world. So that's good. I'm glad we're all on the same page.
So we're over our time as usual, but like, I just want to ask Casey a question here. When we got into this, like however many years ago, call it 10 or more, did you ever think that we would be sitting in a place where we'd be like, yeah, information architecture is your strategic advantage as an organization?
No, it was always, it would be what technology you have. And now it's flipped on its head.
It's just wild to like think about the implications of some of these changes. So there you go.
Incredible. Well, thank you all for being here again on a Friday, and thank you for sticking around, even though we went over time. We love to like hear from you guys about what you want to talk about, what you're hearing in the industry and things like that. So feel free to comment on any of our live streams. They're all on LinkedIn. And you can now listen to all of our live streams on a podcast. So that's super fun. So there's lots of places to listen. So, provide some insight. We're happy to discuss and get into it again at a later date.
Yeah, come connect with us. Say hi, offer us suggestions. We're always happy to pick them up and see what we can do with them. So,
totally. Bye.